Code Fun Podcast Network.
This podcast is brought to you by our friends at Linode. Whether you're working on a personal project or managing your enterprise's infrastructure, Linode has the pricing, support, and scale you need to take your project to the next level. Get started on Linode today by going to linode.com/remoteruby.
This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
Hello.
What's up, Jason?
Yo.
Did you see in the show notes from two episodes ago, they actually, like, people who transcribed the show notes actually put, like, a thing about Andrew, like, leaving Hamel and, like, becoming an ERB Zen user?
No.
Yeah.
Because we joked funny. About it in the shit, like, we were like, hey, please make sure to include that Andrew, like, is team ERB now. And I was reading back through the other day, and I was like, oh, they actually did that.
Oh, man. I got a good look. Our shout out to our editors. They're great.
Yeah, they're fantastic.
It made me so happy. How are y'all? How's life?
I'm good. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how it ended up being Friday already this week. It feels like it should be Wednesday or something, but been playing with lots of Cable Ready, and that's been a blast.
That's cool. We should chat about that more. We started using Reflex at work.
Ooh, what are you using it for?
We're rebuilding one of our existing pages.
Yeah.
So, like, we're slowly, like, moving to our new design system. And, like, our design system uses a completely different set of assets that, like, we pull in from NPM, view component, all the things. And so, as part of that, we're putting Reflex into that, like, new set of tooling we use or trying it.
That's cool.
I worked with Nate Wednesday, and we were able to get Reflex version 3 into our Rails 5.2 app, which is what you're technically not supposed to do. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we can talk about that more in depth later, but yeah.
Cable
Ready is the meat behind Steam.
Right. Yeah, that's where I did the Trello clone a long time ago on Go Rails in Vue, and that worked out really well, but I was like real curious how you could do the same thing with Stimulus Reflex and Cable Ready. And like, it's one of those examples that you can do some with Stimulus Reflex, but to broadcast changes out to other people without blowing away their changes that they might be working on is where you need to drop down into the lower level stuff like Cable Ready so that you can trigger, you know, individual changes instead. And that was, you know, a really good like learning experience to go through that and kind of compare the two approaches. It feels maybe more complicated than the Vue version for Trello, but it kind of makes sense. Like it's a pretty complicated little front end or whatever with lots of nuances and stuff. Like anytime you're having people edit the same things, you end up with some tricky situations.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah. Like, originally, I was trying to broadcast a refresh to everybody else. But if I did that and you were adding a new card or editing something, then it would just blow away your, you know, in interim state there. And, you know, that wasn't really the experience I was hoping for. And I was like, And least bad, he added some PR to my code and we were talking about how to approach that. And he showed me like, no, basically just use Cable Ready. And then I was like, oh yeah, this makes so much sense. And it's like really kind of what you're looking for when you're working with Action Cable a lot. And so that's been my new favorite thing to fiddle with lately. And it's pretty much ready to go. So I should have a screencast out on that pretty soon, which is going to be exciting. Cable Ready to go. Yep.
Cool. Yeah. I have lots to talk about, but that is not our agenda today. We were joined by a guest. Matt, do you mind just maybe give us a quick hello and introduction?
Hey, yeah. I'm Matt Swanson. I am a software engineer based in Indianapolis, and I work at a consulting agency, SCP. I've worked there for about 10 years, and we do all kinds of custom software development for customers. Not often Rails, but I have been doing Rails for about that same amount of time, just on my own. But recently I've been able to use it on some stuff at work. So yeah, been getting back into Rails and writing on a blog that I started recently that's getting, you know, I'm getting a lot of good feedback on, which is Boring Rails at boringrails.com.
Cool. Yeah, I also want to clarify, we were talking about you on a previous episode, and I just called you the Boring Rails guy. And somebody called that out on Twitter, and I was like, oh, that's funny. And it didn't hit me till last night. The implication of that could mean, oh, that's not Boring Rails guy. So I'm glad you're on here now to actually talk about that you have a blog called Boring Rails.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's because I'm getting older, or maybe, you know, there's just so much insanity going on, but boring is definitely a positive in this sense. So,
very cool. Just out of curiosity, so you said you've been doing Rails at work, but it's not necessarily what you always do. What are some other things you work in?
Yeah, so the interesting part about my day job is that we work for a lot of customers that have what we like to think of as like highly complex applications. So this might be things like, you know, autonomous vehicles, like in the agriculture space. It might be doing data analytics for engine performance data from, you know, aircraft engines. The project I'm working on right now is sort of a big knowledge base for pharmaceutical companies. So if you can imagine all the complexities around insurance. So we do a little bit of everything. And so I've worked on, you know, mobile apps. I've worked on .NET web projects. I've worked, you know, in the crazy to me JavaScript land of Node and 5 million NPM packages. And I've really been enjoying my time for the past 2 years working on this project that I've been doing just in the most boring kind of vanilla Rails stack. The whole motivating force behind this is a lot of times when we're working with customers, like there's so much complexity in their domains and in building products that like I just can't also deal with the delivery of the software, not just being a given. So like I know in Rails, for most of the projects that I've worked on, I can build whatever we need. The hard part is figuring out what to build, how it should all work. So it's nice to be able to say like, okay, once we get it into, you know, development, there's no big surprises. And then a lot of the other, you know, tool chains and tech stacks I've worked in, it's not always the case. I mean, if you're building like native mobile apps and you're like, this is what the Spree needs to do, and then you get in there and find that, you know, oh, actually that's not how, you know, the SDKs work. And suddenly something that was ready to go is like, yeah, we have to rethink this because we just like literally can't build this.
Cool. So I think one of the conversations that got started on Twitter was everybody was talking about RailsConf talks, which I admittedly have not watched any of, even though I scheduled a whole day off to do it and then worked the whole day. So yeah, I'm just going to throw it out there and get started. This question is for any of you three. Have you all watched RailsConf talks, and what are some of your favorites?
I've watched a couple, I think probably 7-ish, something like that. I have a few that I've started and haven't finished yet, but I think the one on Webpacker is really good, and it's kind of hard to like see the names of all these when you're looking at it on YouTube, but there was one on Webpacker that was really good. And Kent Beck had a really good one as well.
The Webpacker one, what did it touch on? Was it just like an overview of Webpack or something?
No, it was a bit of a deeper dive into Webpacker from the Shock of Code guy, the one that's behind React Rails or React on Rails.
Yeah, okay. Has the agency in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. And then what was Kent's on?
It was about the relationship of, well, I guess like the core thing he was trying to push was that you should make changes that change behavior and change functionality. I think it was functionality in like stages. So like you shouldn't do them in the same one.
What were the other ones you watched? You said you watched 7?
I think so, yeah. I watched the keynotes. I watched, there was this one action text one. I guess that was okay.
Action text videos are trash.
Yeah.
It's funny because if they're extracting some of those changes from Hey in action text, like most of that may be different in 6.1 or whatever. So we shall see.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to follow that. And I think the DHH keynote was interesting in that sense that it was originally probably going to be more revealing as to what was happening, but then the launch of Hey has been pushed back. And then I think David really wants to do a kind of a big splashy announcement of the product and their other new fancy stuff. But it was really interesting. I liked DHH's keynote a lot. The format was different than his normal keynotes in that it was a Q&A, but the good part is that they covered a lot of ground. So you got to see David's thoughts on, you know, static typing and Ruby 3 and Sorbet and, you know, like linting and microservices and then just some classic, you know, hot takes.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me like his videos walking through different modules or whatever in Basecamp as he was talking through some of that stuff. It felt similar, which if you haven't watched any of those, I'd recommend people go check those out on YouTube. What was the name of that series? I can't remember.
On writing code well.
Yeah. It was a very good little... It was what I think... It like convinced me to go like take a look at concerns more, which I think he explained pretty well in there. And it was kind of neat.
Yeah. I was trying to bait DHH on Twitter to talk a little bit more about the concerns. It's so interesting. Like whenever I see little, you know, pulling back the curtains of some of the Basecamp code base and some of the Hey code base, there was a... Because he showed a model in, I think, in that May WTF forum that we might talk about later in the episode. And they just have so many concerns, and the naming is just like so unique compared to any code base that I've ever seen, like the abstractions that they use. I don't know. It is just really, it's really interesting. And, you know, on one hand, I can be extremely grateful for how open, you know, David and Basecamp have been in sharing stuff. And on the other hand, I just find myself just keep saying like more. I want more. You know, what are you hiding from us?
Yeah, I feel the same way, and I think a lot of people do too. Like, there's just something at Basecamp, like the way they talk about building a business, also feels the same way. Where it's like, you know, they don't take advice from, you know, the startup or Hacker News crowd or whatever, and they kind of look at things differently. And you can see they do that in their code too, which is pretty cool. Because I felt like a lot of the modules and things that they had were well named and well organized and things, and you can see that in like there may be a little bit of a like the internals of ActionText as I was diving into it felt confusing to kind of see how it was all put together, but the way it's organized is like it's fairly modular, but it's definitely the first version of it that they open sourced, where it's like some pieces are a little bit too hard coded and need to be replaceable or whatever. Same thing we're seeing with like active storage. Like you can't do previews or transcode videos and have different formats, but you can with images or whatever. Mm. And, you know, some of those things are pretty neat to see how they approach it, which seems like a different thing than when you compare those tools to other open source packages like Shrine or whatever. They're quite different in their approaches, which is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think DHH really leans hard into like, you know, the kind of Ruby aesthetic of, you know, this beautiful prose. And I think a lot of people, you know, that resonates with them and they like it, but it's like, oh yeah, I'll make like a cute little method with a, you know, question mark in it on this one model. And they're like, no, we're going, you know, taking it to 11 and, you know, making, you know, like all of our models and abstractions this like, you know, strange, maybe not strange, but different style of writing. I mean, and they've got, you know, things like buckets and recordings and some of the Hey stuff he was showing was like clips and boxes. And I'm just thinking like, where's the like email model and where's the like the inbox? Like that's the way that I'm writing software. So it's just really interesting. I mean, I'm sure someone could do an entire series like David was doing of just going into their code base and pulling up interesting things and, you know, open any random file in the app. And I'm sure there's probably something interesting to talk about.
Yeah. To that point, even like watching those videos, when I go to like name something, it makes me want to like, I come up with what my normal name would be. And like, I'm going to go through to a thesaurus and like, see if there's a better name for this. Like, I don't know. It challenges me to like think about things I wouldn't think about before.
Yeah, that's how Nate and I code with thesaurus. I never even thought about it until I met him.
Yeah, I think I've talked about it before. I always get a little lost looking at like the abstractions they do, and maybe because I just don't know the domain, like the whole domain model. But when they open that and like a model is just a bunch of includes, I like have trouble keeping up because I'm sitting there trying to figure out what all those includes do while he's like talking about something else. But it's interesting.
Yeah, they need like some overarching explanation of how it's organized because it takes some time to like understand that. That was like the problem learning Rails, you know, like where does the, what is this params and how does it get here? Like we didn't require it from anywhere. And it's it probably seems similar when you're including modules like that. And you're like, okay, we called a method here. Where the heck did that come from? You know, and if you're familiar with how it's organized, then it's fine, but it abstracts stuff away to a point where you're like, somebody new will struggle with it a bit more, but it's also feels more intuitive at a point when you know how it's architected. This kind of makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, we're all on that concern life at CodeFun. So when I see those videos, like it makes sense to me and it like that entire kind of pattern of architecture makes sense. But coming in, I was like, oh yeah, where is this method? But it depends on how the code is architected, but it didn't take me very long to kind of figure it out because it was so well organized when I got there.
It does feel like, you know, as Rails has drifted and more things have gotten added to it, that I think it's overall just kind of missing that like reference application that's, you know, been built out in this particular, you know, Basecamp-y, you know, vanilla Rails style. And it's interesting. And, you know, Andrew, I think it's definitely cool that the CodeFund app people can poke around with. And I know I've definitely looked into the concerns folders and the stimulus controllers and just poked around to see, you know, what kind of things you guys are doing.
Well, don't poke too far. You may find something. Don't get blame anything that looks suspicious.
Were there any other notable Rails comp videos?
The engines one, Monoliths Between Microservices by Vladimir.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that was an engines talk.
Yeah, because they're basically organizing their microservices as Rails engines. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'll have to watch that one. I don't think I got to that. So did they have some examples of how they do that?
Yes, they did. And I'm not going to be able to replay it to you. I watch these videos in like 2x speed and kind of like take the high arching ideas and then just go stalk the people on GitHub.
Yeah, I felt like I fully intended to sit down and watch a bunch of these. And then I watched DHH and Aaron Patterson and that was it. And like ended up answering emails and doing work instead. It felt kind of... It's definitely easier when you got 3 days off at the conference to go and attend the talks versus these. You feel like you can put them off and watch them later, and then you may not ever watch them. It's different this year, but
to be fair, that's what we said when we weren't going to the talks last year.
Yeah,
get back.
So. Yeah.
Well, they'll be recorded. We can just watch them later.
Did any of you guys go to the hallway track or whatever that Mike Perham and other people were doing?
I did.
And, you know, I tried to pop in there and I tried a couple different times throughout the day and there was nobody there. So maybe I just missed the rush or picked a bad time, but I wasn't able to connect up with anybody. So I just took myself to Twitter and started tweeting.
Yeah, I think Mike was popping in at the top of every hour pretty much and hanging out for a little bit. So he posted a picture at some point from it, and you can see me in there not paying attention per usual.
I think the lack of a schedule did make it a little bit difficult. I'd be kind of curious if they gave any consideration to like running the talks on a schedule like they would normally like live stream them, even if it wasn't live, but then having it like then the next day we'll post all of them. Because like at a conference, there's more clear like shared breaks where like, okay, you know, from 11:30 to 11:45, there's no talks going on, so people can go in the hallway versus this. And I'm in the same bucket as Andrew. I was watching these at, you know, 2x speed and, you know, multiple tabs up and flipping around and, you know, take a break, go outside, get lunch, come back. So I think it was probably harder to sync up with people.
Yeah, that would have been cool to do on Twitch or YouTube Live or something and stream them in order or whatever with breaks and just kind of simulate the same schedule. That would be kind of awesome.
Yeah, I'm sure the reason that they specifically didn't do it though is because at a conference, you know, everyone's there in the same time zone. But if you were to stream them, like I imagine because most of the RailsConf organizers live in the United States, that they would probably do it in the United States schedule. So you're basically excluding everyone else, like in England and Japan and stuff like that. So I imagine that's why they didn't do that, just because it would be almost an exclusive thing unless they did several of them, and then who's got the time to do that?
Yeah, and you know, they would have had to travel to the US to attend in person or whatever anyways, but yeah, it's not, there's not a good solution for everyone to be able to be there at once, and then you get stuck in a chat room or whatever instead of the hallway actually talking to people. So yeah, you guys watch any other talks that you liked?
Yeah, there's a couple that I think maybe might not catch folks based on the title that I thought were pretty good. There was one talk that I really liked that was about bug bounties. And I initially was like, well, I'm not running a bug bounty. I'm not working on a project that is going to be like a public facing thing. But that was only sort of half the talk. So this was by Jason Meller, works at Collide.
I know him and one of my really good friends used to work there at Collide.
Yeah, I just thought it was like a really good practical mix of like the UX and the dev side, like, and not just a security talk. So a lot of these security talks are like, here's these vulnerabilities, these are all the bad things that can happen. And I thought Jason did a really good job talking about kind of evaluating security issues through this lens of like, what's the potential downside, and then what's the amount of effort it's going to take to mitigate it. So one of the examples that he shared was like, there's the vulnerability where someone can check if an account exists using like the password reset thing. So if you code up your application in such a way that you have a password reset form and I'm not logged in, I can type in Chris's email, and if it says, all right, we sent you the password instructions to your inbox, well, if you're actually checking that account exists and sending the email, then you're sort of disclosing to me that Chris has signed up for your service. So that's technically it is a security issue. Now, you know, Jason was saying, well, on the other hand, if you have someone who's legitimately trying to reset their password and they use a different email address, and now you've got a huge support ticket burden from people that are confused, and you know, the screen saying, hey, we sent this email, but you really didn't because you don't want to disclose it. So like, how do you kind of balance that? So I thought it was just a really good practical way of improving the security of your application, but it wasn't so much one of these like, here's a checklist of all the things that, you know, you're doing wrong that need to be immediately fixed. Otherwise, you know, your app is going to get hacked and it'll be the disgrace of the development community.
That's the funny part about a lot of security stuff is you can end up making the app like unusable for people if you go too far with it. Or it's like, you know, it's like Bitcoin. If you lose your wallet and we have a way to recover that, then like people are just going to abuse that to go steal Bitcoins. And so like you can't do that with the Bitcoin stuff, which also adds like an extreme level of like, you better know exactly who you're sending money to because you're not getting that money back. There's no refunds there, which are like, you know, another example of like to make things easier for people and not piss them off, you have to have some of that stuff that may be less, maybe slightly less secure or whatever, and or more burdensome in some way to make it functional in a more user-friendly manner.
Yeah, and there's another good example in the talk where I think most people who are listening to this podcast have probably had been on GitHub, and sometimes when you change the settings, like this, you know, the billing settings or the security settings, it reprompts you for your password to do kind of like an extra confirmation. So he walked through a pretty clean implementation of that he was referring to as pseudo mode. So like entering into kind of like a pseudo mode inside of your session that would then allow you to do like high risk account things for a certain time. So that was just something that is really good, I think, to have in your back pocket. Like I don't have that need at the moment on anything I'm working on, but just a little like pointer back to like, oh yeah, if I ever need to do something like that, like there's a talk explaining some of the trade-offs you have to make, and had some nice sample code to at least get started.
That's pretty cool. I like that. I'll have to watch that and see, because I've always, you know, I've never needed that feature, but I've always wondered how you would implement it. And that seems like a thing you see pretty commonly around, you know, different sites. And I think it's a kind of a cool thing, because I guess it's protecting against, you know, you're at the office, you leave yourself signed in, or somebody sits down at your computer while you step away. They could go like, you know, transfer your GitHub repo to them or something. And it's like trying to prevent that, unless your password manager auto fills out your password for you.
Yeah. And I think it was also helping if you had the issue where someone had like an active session that was working, you know, like if they had logged in and then, you know, you detected it, changed your password or whatever, but until they've been like forced out of there. So the idea with the sudo thing, I think, was that there was like a time-based expiration. So it's like, if you've re-authenticated with like your fresh credentials in the past 30 minutes, then you have access. But if somebody, you know, had an old session that was lying around that they could replay, then they couldn't get into the real high value stuff. So
nice. Yeah,
I thought it was overall a really good talk, and you know, don't be, you know, misled by thinking it's only for folks that are either interested in, you know, using bug bounties as a way of making money or hosting them publicly. There's some gems in there.
That's cool. Did any of you guys watch the building a Rails controller from scratch?
No, I didn't get to that one yet.
That was on my list to watch. I haven't watched it yet either. What else? Any other good ones that were notable?
Emily Girello did a good one on successfully onboarding juniors that folks may want to check out. And Christian Buckmayer did a really interesting one on creating a performance analytics tool with active support. That was a technical tutorial. So I think that was a pretty good one to check out.
Yeah.
And
I really like that performance analytics talk. I think maybe a better pitch for it would have been like, watch me build like a mini New Relic in, you know, 20 minutes. I just thought it's neat. It's always neat to see people build like a stripped down version of something. So obviously, you know, if you need all the features that something like New Relic or Skylight or any of these other tools have, it didn't cover all of it, but like it covered just a little, the core gem of it, of how do you like instrument your application in a way that doesn't involve you manually putting, you know, benchmarking code in your app.
Andrew, you mentioned there's one other video.
Joel Hawksley had a good one on components that I recommend.
Did you learn from it?
Well, there was at the very end, and I'm trying to remember the name of the method, so that's why I didn't say it right off the bat. But he showed at the very end how it's called like find or fall back. So I think it was a way of them saying like, okay, maybe this button has several variants, and they try to find that variant, or if it doesn't exist, to fall back on like a default one. And then production, so that in production that never breaks and you never have like a component that's stopping your page from rendering. But in development, they raise on it so that you can fix it then. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it seems really handy. Like you want to, I guess it's maybe similar to the strong params, like silently failing in production, but raising an error in development. You want to know about it so that you're not, you don't miss it in development, but in case it ever happens in production, you don't give a 500 error.
Yeah.
Nice. That's a good one. I only made it maybe halfway through that one before I took a break. So I'll have to go back and finish that episode. I'm really excited to see that. And then did he talk at all? Because when we chatted with him on the Ruby Blend, I know he was talking about like, they're basically opening it up so that like view component will be one of many options that you could have as, you know, components in Rails, which I thought was interesting. I'm kind of curious if anybody else is working on a alternative too. It'd be kind of neat to see.
Yeah, he didn't touch on that, but I am also interested in watching that evolve.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a thread on GitHub or something that's talking about, you know, extracting that into a interchangeable thing instead, because all I remember seeing was the announcement that it wasn't going to be in Rails core.
Yeah, I think he talked a little bit in this year's RailsConf. It's somewhat confusing because at RailsConf 2019, I think Joel gave a very similar talk, which was sort of the kind of intro of like, here's this thing we're doing. Isn't it neat? And you know, now we're sort of a year later and gone through the whole life cycle. And I think you all have covered, you know, some of what's been happening with the gem and getting in, you know, was it going to be in Rails proper? Was it not? So, yeah.
This is an aside on components. Didn't they remove the validations? Like you have to bring in active model validations yourself now?
Yes, I think so. And he touched on that a little bit, but not really directly, but he basically showed that they had a validation on a component that like took down production or something.
Interesting. So we have made use of that, and we're going to have to, before we update, go through and change all that.
Yeah, I don't use the validations because I don't want the component to cause the page not to render. There's a render method that you can call, like render question mark, to see whether the component's going to render or not. So I basically do a check in there.
Did you know that feature came out of Podia?
I did not know that.
Kyle Fox, one of my coworkers, has been like kind of involved with it silently, I guess. And he opened a PR and several of us commented like, why are you having these conditionals? And so then he just PR'd it, the render thing.
Yeah, I use that constantly. So
it's really cool. Podia. I'm really grateful that he did it. So I don't know. I don't think we touched on this last week. If we did, not as in depth as we can now. We have an entire thread of Rails WTFs that came about from some tweets, I think, from Advi. And I don't check it every day, but check in on it, I don't know, a couple times a week. Pretty interesting stuff in there. Anything in there anybody wants to discuss?
I will just say that Betsy, and I'm not Heibel, maybe is how you pronounce her last name. She's kind of been one of the moderators on it. She was also in that original thread with Avdi when DHH kind of like offered to do this. And so she has been moderating in there and asking questions and helping people clear up. And I just want to say she's doing an amazing job. And like the level of just professionalism that she's handling some people that are not being as professional is just really good to watch. And whenever someone has like an issue or something and they kind of talk about it in the thread, she always pushes them to open a PR, kind of explains how they would go about that. So shout out to her because she's doing, it's really refreshing kind of to watch that some of these threads are just people kind of complaining, but she's doing a really good job of kind of coming in and trying to set like an actionable purpose for the thread and pushing people to do PRs and calling people out when they're not behaving in a way that is like productive.
And doing it in such like a calm tone. Like,
yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. I couldn't do that. Some people, some snarky comments on here and I would have just been like, all right, well, you know what? Cracks knuckles.
Yeah. It's just a good place, you know, to vent a little for a lot of people. And yeah, it's not always constructive, but it's good to see you know, people are frustrated with a lot of different things and pretty much everything has been mentioned on here. I feel like that, like definitely the confusion around what happened to sprockets and like, it's still here sort of for styles, but then, you know, anybody who's using Tailwind or something is not needing it at all. And it's like pretty confusing to a lot of people. And even those little things of like, some people want UUIDs as primary keys or to make them easier. And it's interesting to see the conversation and get into some of those things. Like, you know, Jason, we've talked about having authentication or something a little bit more baked into the framework, and DHH weighed in on that. And I'm talking about, it's unlikely we'll ever get something like Devise officially in or maintained by the Rails core team, but maybe we'll have more stuff that is more than has secure password, which would be kind of nice.
One thing Phoenix just, or they're working on, they introduced, but Jose just worked on building a generator for their auth stuff.
Yeah.
So it's not like a dependency that like gets updated, but it's like a one-time run this, have your auth set up. It's really interesting. And I was especially interested considering his relationship with Devise in the past.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, like, a lot of the confusion with Devise is like, how do I change it to do what I want? And if you gave, here's a example, you know, that you get and you can tweak it to your heart's content, that's pretty much what I think most people are looking for. Or they just want a way to, like, you know, here we'll authenticate with passwords or JWTs or OAuth or whatever. And they're looking for just a example, you know, to start with. And Devise does, you know, the majority of that or can do all of it. But, you know, it's also like the controllers being inside of Devise makes it confusing to anybody who wants to go customize that. They got to override those or, you know, copy paste them out of the gem so they can fully change it however they want. That can be confusing. And I definitely like the idea of a generator that installs a session controller, a, you know, reset your password controller, and a registration controller. That seems like something that would be really nice to have.
It's interesting. I think there's other tools in the world that do this sort of thing. And I think it's
Clearance.
Yeah, you sort of want to like eject, like out of the gem. It's like you can use it out of the box, fine. But then instead of saying like in Devise, you kind of like customize, like, oh, you can customize like one individual view or one controller, or, you know, you could override like the callback in your user model. It's more like you just completely eject and like copy paste everything and then sort of own it.
Yeah, that seems like something that you kind of see commonly in views, at least for like Devise. You can just install the views, or, you know, your admins and kind of install the dashboard or the views for it or the controllers, and then you can go change it. It might be a good approach. I wonder if part of the concern with that is like, you know, Rails 7 comes out and has some breaking changes to it, then you got to go change your views and it's not as easy to upgrade. Maybe that is one of the concerns.
It would certainly be a bigger pain for folks that are maintaining. Because once you get out, it's like, oh, if you've ejected and then we need to change something or we want to add some new thing, it's like, well, you can't depend on people not having, you know, changed that controller before. But In user land, I think I would definitely prefer something like that to, you know, the Devise as it currently exists.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see what comes out of that, because they were kind of talking about Warden, what powers Devise for the actual authentication. You know, what if we pulled out some primitives like that and gave you that as a foundation? I think that could be interesting, but not having the controllers and stuff already done for you seems like that's kind of the thing people really want to me.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a fine line to balance that. Andrew, I know we were talking on Twitter about Spring. We're just kind of discussing like
the Spring.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, man, Spring is such a weird one because, like, in theory, it's supposed to be seamless and you never notice it, but like, it doesn't work that way. I'm not sure why, but it is. You know, basically the only time you notice it is when it's not working, and it's really frustrating when it isn't. And so there's never a feeling where you're like, oh man, I love Spring. It's only the like frustrating side of things. And yeah, that's definitely one I hope that maybe gets addressed. I think it's using, you know, file system utilities to monitor for changes and reload things, but that doesn't seem reliable, but I don't know the internals of it. Nor have I ever really like filed issues or bug reports or whatever with Spring. So I feel like a lot of people probably are in the same boat of like find the frustration, but don't really know how to go, you know, surface those. How do you do that repeatably so that, you know, Spring can have an issue to go and work on and fix and improve? It seems like a hard gem to maintain.
That reminded me of, I read a thing about in that WTF thread. So like, you know, you instantiate an object, you make a change, and then you reload, but like that reference to that object is stale, like it's a stale version. Mm-hmm. There was talk about like, what if we just automatically reloaded things for you? And that was kind of don't know, that was kind of changed into, well, what if in Rails, like in your Rails console, and you have instantiated object assigned to a variable, you do a reload and you access it, what if we just told you that version was stale? And I was like, that would help so much. Like, that's, I don't want to say it's a little thing because I don't know what it takes to implement that, obviously. But like, in terms of like seeing it, that little help, like that little helper text would help so much. Because literally the next day I was at work, and like we kept running into that. We're like, we'd reload and forget we had instantiated something, assigned it earlier on. So I think that'd be a cool thing if that comes out.
That would be pretty cool. I guess I would have to keep track of like the version of the instance or something, you know, but that's probably doable with some sort of class variable or something that gets incremented each time it gets reloaded or something. That'd be kind of cool. Yeah. I think those little things would make a, you know, a big improvement to it for sure. Cause then you, like, it's up to you to understand a little bit of the internals of how reloading works in order to debug that right now. And if it's just more descriptive, at least it can tell you and you can be like, oh, of course. And it's not a point of frustration as much anymore. It's like an education point of how things work behind the scenes. Were there any of these other ones in here that, ooh, there's the no search in Rails guides I just came across. I remember that.
I was scared to bring that up because I thought it might trigger you.
Yeah, so basically somebody, I forget who it was, we talked about basically on GitHub issues, you know, the Rails guides could use a search and that would be really nice. And one of the proposals was basically, Tony Denke started the issue, I guess last May. And basically it was like, you know, it'd be nice to have search on the Rails docs. And there's a long conversation about that, you know, and a lot of the other docs are searchable, not on just the current page, but across the entire docs, like Tailwind's docs are run by Algolia and they have an open source tool for that. But there was no discussion of not wanting to promote a product like Algolia and whatever. And, you know, it's good to see that that stuff's kind of resurfaced because I feel like the Rails API docs are particularly frustrating. And like, I tend to go look at API doc a lot more. There's comments there, which can be helpful sometimes. And, you know, the Rails docs are just kind of minimal and don't have easy navigation to other things that it might be referencing or other classes in the module and so on. So I'd love to see those docs improved. Feels like they need to do a revamp of those. They're getting kind of old. It'd be nice to see.
So I'm not too familiar with how the whole feature process works on, you know, the Rails repository, and maybe one of you all knows a little bit more, but I think it would be interesting if an outcome of this, you know, May WTF project was almost, and I wonder if there's a connection even to some of the like Ryan Singer Shape Up Basecamp stuff of like, if the outcome of this was, here are some pitches for big efforts that, you know, we'd like someone to tackle. And here are some of the guardrails, but, you know, this has been blessed by, you know, David or someone on the core team as like, here, you know, I think that search case is a good example of like, you know, before someone goes to work on implementing this, I'm not sure. And maybe there is a process that I'm just not aware of. Like, how would anyone even know that that would like ultimately be approved regardless of the implementation? So I don't know, maybe there's something there where they can say like, yes, we are thumbs up on adding search to this. The constraints are, hey, it can't be, you know, a third party commercial thing, or it can be, or here's some guardrails, and then, you know, someone else can go off and run with it and take the discussion to GitHub. And yeah, I don't know. Do you all have any more knowledge into how that process normally goes, or if there's something like that that already exists?
Yeah, you know, that seems like one of the tough things, because I've been watching the PR for the Active Storage is getting like a proxy option for the URLs, so you can run them through, you know, a CDN instead of directly through Rails or whatever. And it's been interesting to see the back and forth on that, because basically, like, the feedback on it was good. Like we could use this, but it's taken 6 or 8 months to get, you know, back and forth on he's building it. They don't, maybe don't quite like the API, and the exact like implementation changed a whole bunch of times, and it's finally getting wrapped up to, you know, be released, I think, in the next version. But it seems like it's pretty ad hoc, and whoever has the time to like look at the PR and whatever, if it's a smaller feature, it's usually pretty quick because somebody who's in charge of, you know, if they're doing active record stuff and you add a feature there, it's usually pretty quick to get approved or not. But yeah, it seems like, you know, it's hard to go and do some of that stuff or like propose, I guess, with like the GitHub draft PRs. That may be helpful, or you could submit a draft PR and be like, hey, I'd like to see it. Because one of the things that I would like to see is the virtual attributes with the attributes API. I think it was that, or no. Yeah, maybe it was that plus the serialized stores as YAML or JSON or whatever. Basically, casting to a format was not really an option. And I tried to open a PR to do that. And it was just kind of like, eh, I don't know if we want to do this, or it's pretty complicated to handle every use case. And I was like, well, where do we draw the line? And it pretty much died there because it was like, well, if you have some example cases that are like, you know, too complex, then let's either decide we don't support those, or like, you know, we'll try and make it work, but we need some examples of what wouldn't. And so, you know, I had something that was pretty straightforward that did the basics as an example, and it just kind of died there. And I'd like to see that kind of stuff revived, but I didn't feel like there was a great way for me to like take that and morph it into something that would get accepted by the core team there. And it was kind of, it's kind of tough, but that's probably a couple of years old now at this point. And maybe it's more welcome now or something.
So I just looked because I knew there was a way to do this and I couldn't remember, and I knew it wasn't through GitHub issues. So on the Rails guide to contributing to Rails, it says, do not put feature request items in GitHub issues. If it's a new feature, then you need to write the code yourself or convince someone to help you write it. And if you would like feedback on an idea or before doing that, you can make a pitch by sending it an email to the Rails core mailing list, and then people might respond or not, but GitHub issues does not the place to do it.
And it's such a big project that makes sense. Like it just, it maybe is one of those things that like, it would be nice if it was in somewhere in GitHub better, or like nudge people that direction to the mailing list better or something to organize that. Or maybe the GitHub discussions, if that comes out for the Rails repo, would be able to help that. Just tag those as like proposals or something, because sometimes, like, you know, those you want to see if, for me, I was like hacking on that because I wanted that feature, but I also wanted to see if I could add it and learn enough active record or active model to build it. So it was just good for me to learn it for the most part.
Yeah, you know, I'm totally empathetic to, you know, these large projects and like getting tens, hundreds, you know, thousands of bug reports and feature requests, you know, a year. It just, it kind of puts folks that are interested in contributing into a bit of a bind of like not knowing what is like sanctioned to work on or even has any chance of getting in. And I know it's not an easy project, especially as at the scale of something like Rails.
Andrew, have you filed your issue to make everything default by and only allow HAML?
I have not. You guys have broken my spirit. I was a young, wild lover of HAML, and you guys have made me a grumpy old man
who lives. We've shown you the light. We've shown you the light, even though
you haven't shown the light. You've closed the shutters on the light. The light is no more. I live in darkness.
That's fine. Right. I'll take that. I'm good with that.
Yeah.
I've definitely been following this HAML saga, and I'm like the opposite way in that I am using HAML, and I kind of wish that I wasn't. So I don't know if you've ever run into these things, but in Tailwind, they have like the W-half and W-third utilities, and the slashes don't work so nicely in HAML. And I also have had a lot of trouble with indentation on like stimulus controllers where you want to go multi-line, and Haml just gives me more fits than ERB. So maybe we should trade, you know, views. I'm sure I could just take your folder and you can take mine and it'll just plug into the apps without any problem.
I've heard that Slim fixes some of those issues you just mentioned. But as far as the issues you did just mention, I kind of held my ears and said, la, 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 la. Let me keep the dream alive. But no, I don't want
to. I certainly don't miss the like closing end tags in an ERB.
Right? All my files at this, most of the views in CodeFund at this point are mostly like Ruby. So if I had Haml, I wouldn't have the problems of like a file at the very end of the file. There's like 20 lines of end. So
yeah,
I hate that.
Now, the weird part is I actually didn't like that proposal I saw for Ruby methods that didn't have end in them. But now that I think about it, it's sort of the same like Python style that I want in my views, but not in my my backend code.
Yeah, I don't think I would want that in the backend, but I would love it on the view.
You know, Andrew, I'm thinking about this past week or last week when I helped a coworker trace down a bug and it was a missing end. And you know what? I didn't enjoy that. And I will.
No, it sucks.
I will throw Haml a point that way, but then I will take it back when I do the wrong indentation.
Hey, get better at indentation.
I should just learn how to program.
Yeah, if you learned how to program, then you would realize that Haml is the light.
The best way to write views is with markers and papers.
Well, only if you do it on like a surface you can't erase, so it becomes permanent.
Well, I think that is what markers and papers do. So
I draw my views on the wall.
Before we wrap up, anything else we want to discuss today?
I can't think of anything.
Death to spring. No more spring.
Spring actually hasn't been bothering me lately.
Well, it bothers me.
Are we always going to be on the opposite end?
No.
Are you just trolling again?
Maybe because I was about to say, no, we're not always on the opposite end. And then I thought about that one time we paired and you wanted to get rid of active storage or whatever. I was like, no, that's the worst idea I've ever heard.
But I like that, though. I need you in my life. I need someone to challenge me.
So. He's the devil on your shoulder.
Or just obstinate.
I like
challenging by choice.
I always get so nervous that you're going to get angry at me. That's my biggest fear in life.
Who, me or Chris?
You. I talked to my therapist. She's like, how was your week? And I was like, well, I almost made Andrew mad on our podcast.
What? I don't get mad ever.
No, you're the best. Matt, thanks for joining us. I wanted to ask if you have any places you want to share, people can find you online, any...
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier I've been writing some sort of in-depth from the trenches articles at boringrails.com. If you're into, you know, the kind of default Rails stack with Stimulus and Turbolinks and all that, definitely check that out. And if you have anything you want to tell me, you can reach me on Twitter at _Swanson.
Awesome. I see that there's a possibility Boring Rails might become a book. And when that happens, we'd love to have you back and talk some more about that.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks for having me today. It was fun chatting about some RailsConf stuff and just the general state of what's happening in Rails land.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. I will talk to you guys next week then.
All right. We'll see you.
See ya.
Later.
This podcast is brought to you by our friends at Linode. With 11 data centers worldwide, including their newest data center in Sydney, Australia, enterprise-grade hardware, S3-compatible storage option, and their next-generation network, Linode delivers the performance you expect at a price that you don't. Get started on Linode today by going to linode.com/remoteruby.